Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Unscrewed, the show that knows that real liberation includes sexual liberation. I am your host, Jacqueline Friedman, and on this week's Unscrewed, we're going to have a conversation about masculinity. And I know this can be a little touchy, especially I know there are a lot of male listeners, and most of us love somebody who's a man. So I want to say up front, like, this isn't about men being bad, but also, at the same time, we have to admit there's something going wrong with masculinity. And I ranted about it on last week's show, but I wanted to have a more productive conversation this week about what we can do collectively as a culture and a series of interlocking communities that would be better for men and also for the rest of us. And for that, I could think of nobody better to talk to than Karen BK Chan, who is a sex and emotional literacy educator who's based in Toronto and does just really wonderful, cutting edge, compassionate thinking and research along these lines. So Karen BK Chan, thank you for being on Unscrewed.
Thanks so much, Jacqueline. It is always lovely to talk to you.
Yeah. So obviously, there's so much to talk about, but as you know, on Unscrewed, we always start with a little lightning round of the same questions. So the first one is, what has been making you happy this week?
Puppy. Well, I call her my puppy, but really she's a dog. But in my heart, she's my puppy. Maybe that will annoy her, but
Mom!
She's my puppy. Yeah. Puppy.
Aw.
Yeah.
That's good. That's excellent. That's a great answer. What is some of the best sex advice you've ever received?
Best sex advice would be to be brave, to be really brave and put your heart or your desires or your vulnerabilities on your sleeve. It's very sexy. It's turned out to be very useful.
Yeah, that is very sexy when you really commit to it. That's wonderful. And I love the definition of bravery as vulnerability.
Oh, yeah.
That's really wonderful. All right. What has been making you the maddest or saddest lately when it comes to current events around sex and sexuality?
Well, you know, I live in Toronto, or Toronto to the rest of the world. And it was here that recently there was an attack. And so I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about it throughout the show, but I think that it happened, that it was very specifically violence that is connected to sexual pain, and subsequently all the fallout from it and how people have been talking about it, it just makes me not want to talk about it. I'm looking forward to talking about it though with you. I feel like this is going to be a conversation I want to have, but you know, overhearing a lot of the things that are not helpful.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of pain to go around. Yeah. And a lot of anger to go around too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. What is the biggest myth about sex that you used to believe but don't believe anymore?
There are people who are hot. Like,
that's a good one.
Some kind of classifiable definition that there are people who are hot and there are people who are not.
Yes.
Yeah. Right?
Fuck that shit. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah.
I'm glad we're on the same page.
We are on the same page about that. I mean, it's something that I have to continually relearn. Like, that idea definitely has not been excised from my brain, but I don't believe it philosophically, for sure.
Yeah, and I mean that, like, universally. Like, I certainly find certain people hot, like, and other people not. But so I don't want to, you know, remove that evaluative assessment from my brain. But, you know, like, universally, like, I'm talking to 16-year-olds and they're talking about, you know, she's a 10, he's a 5, mm-hmm. you know, things like that. Just that I truly know that to be a myth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Last question. Who is someone who's doing really brave work right now to unscrew the sexual culture that you want to give a shout out to?
Well, I think everyone loves her. So I wish I was like, giving a shout out to somebody like smaller and unknown, but unfortunately, my biggest love is Esther Perel, and I think she just says really smart things, and does it with such a genuine curiosity about people and a very kind heart. So I gotta say, it's her.
Yeah. Her podcast was so gripping.
It's so great. Yeah. So great. I just wish I was her, you know, apprentice, friend, and daughter, and client.
Amazing. Well, I hope you get to be one of those things, at least.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, you should be more than one of those things.
Yeah, probably all those things at once would be complicated and possibly conflicted. Yeah. But
yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. You survived the lightning round.
Thank you. All right.
So I'm really hurt and angry about men right now.
Yeah.
And I'm not a person who generally is like, fuck men, right? Like, mm-hmm. but it's challenging my intimate relationship with a man right now, mm-hmm. like, who is a lovely, sweet, well-meaning human. And it is hard not to be like, what the ever-loving fuck men. Like,
yeah.
And I know that is not your approach, which is why I want to talk to you.
Doesn't mean I don't feel those
things. Do you feel those things too?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't feel them in way when I'm like conscious of what I'm about to feel. So sure. As in, if I'm about to do a workshop or a training and I'm about to talk about masculinities and I'm talking about power and differences, I prepare for that somehow mentally. Right. So I'm thinking I'm a bridge here. I'm going to do some work here and I'm bracketing some of my own feelings. And I come from a long history of dissociation. So compartmentalization of my feelings is easy. But and I mean, I say that both, you know, knowing that it's painful, but also it's like a side perk of that skill. And I like to do it when it's conscious. The other part of it is when I get triggered, basically, in the world, when I'm not ready, mm-hmm. when I'm not an educator, when I don't think I'm here to serve, when I'm just living my life, I feel a lot of the anger and the both like seething anger and hatred, and then a lot of sadness and pain and despair and helplessness.
Yeah, like there's definitely despair in it too. Like,
yeah.
I just fucking give up. Like, you know, the Schneiderman, I don't know how much you got the news about the New York Attorney General up in Canada.
Yeah.
But Schneiderman, like, when my friends, like, panicked me about Trump, I'm like, it's okay. Like, if Mueller has to get taken down, like, Schneiderman will get him, right? Like,
right, right.
Like, Schneiderman is part of, like, my sanity plan for, like, how we're going to get out of this, most of us alive, right? And then I was like, oh, right, like men's violent and grieved entitlement to women's bodies ruins literally everything, like yeah. just like literally everything. And it was like some straw breaking a back of some kind. But like that, you know, and Juno Diaz, like there's just like, mm-hmm. it just feels like there's constant drumbeat. And I was literally talking to a friend of mine about this yesterday when another friend of ours posted a thing about like, Facebook's reorganization of like product design for better accountability. And it was like 20 guys one woman and one of the guys was maybe Indian, like,
right,
and the rest of them were white, and
right,
and I literally tweeted like, the world is canceled, like, I give, you know, like, it's overwhelming right now. And I really do try, like you do, although I think I succeed less than you do, as an educator, to be like, you know, like, my philosophical stance is like, we can change. Everything that is the culture can be changed because we created it. And there's nothing inherent about men that makes them this way. You know, like, we are living in a really bad structure, and we need to figure out how to dismantle it and build something better.
Yeah.
But, like, it's really hard to hang on to that shit, man.
It is. But, you know, in those moments, I think about my parents, who are invested in a relationship with me. And so what I ask of both of them in order to connect with me and to be a decent person in my books, because they are really decent people in their books. But in my books, like, I'm asking for things like vulnerability, you know, I don't even know how to translate that. And in those moments, I think, okay, these are people who are actually invested in doing this. And we've been trying for, you know, 41 years. Well, maybe we've only been actively trying for two decades, not four, but like, it's not going very far, and we see each other a lot. But I do see change, right? Like, there's change. Like, my mom is phenomenal. She went from being really about to disown me for being queer and coming out to her to becoming somewhat of an advocate among her peers. And that took, you know, years. And other things take years. And so I think sometimes about them, and they're invested, and a random guy on the street or in my workplace or at the head of the organization that I'm working with, they might be invested in some kind of outcome, but they don't even love me. Why are they going to change? It's going to take even longer. So I just think about my parents as like a calibration tool. And that I think also, okay, so I'm going to do a part of that work. Jacqueline's going to do a part of that work, and everyone's going to do a part of that work, and none of us will see results, because that will be like 100 years from now. But still, we got to do it. That's how, sometimes, I don't know if that's defeatist or if actually very encouraging.
I think that's the only way to be real about it. I mean, in my good moments, that's what I tell other activists as well, which is like, you plant a seed and somebody else is going to water it, and somebody else is going to be the sunlight, right, and you almost never see the fruits of your work.
Yeah,
but it's really hard sometimes. So I want to talk about your work. So, you know, like, you and I know what we're talking about, but my listeners mostly don't. I'm thinking about this workshop you did a couple of years ago at the National Sex Ed Conference that just really blew my mind and sort of and shifted my thinking and sort of opened my thinking a little about men and accountability for violence and how we raise boys and men and the sort of emotional literacy piece of all of that. Sort of, how do we, it's so hard for me to like phrase these questions. I'll even just be transparent, because like, either they sound too soft or too hard, right? Like, part of me wants to be like, how do we help men be better? And then I'm like, fuck that shit. They need to just get their shit together. And then there's the, like, part of me that wants to be like, well, how do we fix masculinity? And then I hear all the angry letters and tweets being composed in my head about like, men are fighting, we don't need you to fix us, fuck you. Like, so I don't even know like the neutral way to phrase this question, but maybe you can answer it anyway.
maybe I should answer like all of the questions.
Yeah, I'm really in my feelings today, I'm sure, in case you couldn't tell.
I think of it as when people are trying to sell something, it's a very particular set of skills. And, you know, I think in different industries, in different fields, we actually end up using similar skills, right? And so in marketing, it might be called knowing your customer, or if your competitors will call it manipulation. And in therapy,
and someone else will call it propaganda. Yeah, exactly.
And in therapy, the same thing, I think, is called empathy. the same thing is called really understanding and working with, and in social services, it's called client-centered. So when I think about working with men and shifting whatever possible, you know, culture, maybe behavior, maybe, but maybe mostly I'm interested in culture, less in behavior. I think one follows the other. I think about buy-in. Yeah. I think about my customers, these men, they're interested in something. They're never going to buy what I have to sell in terms of ideas that they're not in, that don't serve their interests.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's the frustrating part. So none of the stuff where I'm saying you're a terrible person, even if I just say because of how masculinity has shaped you, is interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't think many people are facing themselves that way. Maybe a few people, after they have witnessed some horrific thing they've done, they might think, wow, I'm a terrible person and I want to change.
But most people are really invested in thinking of themselves as good people.
And because they do try. I think back on times in my life when I've behaved really badly, you know, to my parents or to peers or to coworkers and so on. Those are all times when I felt truly justified. You know, I felt like either I was being attacked or I was being excluded or I was being bothered and annoyed. And so I really was living my truth and doing my best. So I think to sell to my potential customers, customers of thought, customers of culture, I really do have to know where they're at, which means I can't do it every day because sometimes I'm all about where I'm at, not where they're at.
And how do these clients, customers, men come to you?
You know, sometimes I'm related to them and I'm kind of brought into their lives. But a lot of times I'm doing trainings where they're mixed. You know, I don't know if you find this when a bunch of men or boys are brought into a room to talk about being boys and men, often there's a lot of defensiveness. Mm-hmm. And I don't find that to be a very, like, I feel like it's a bit of a setup for the educator and it's a bit of a setup for the participants. So a lot of the people I really do actually connect with are in random places where I'm training a bunch of teachers, for example, on how to talk about sex with their gym class, you know, and then half of the teachers are men. And then that's when I think talking about masculinity can actually be quite fruitful because they're open and I'm going to keep them in an open zone. I call it the stretch zone, which I did talk about in that workshop. And so now I orient everything I do with that framework, which is I need my audience to be in their stretch zone and I need myself to be in my stretch zone. And anytime we're either one of us is outside of that, it's nobody's changing anything. We're just exhausting ourselves.
I think it's so important that you pointed out that you and they are just not always going to be in their stretch zone and that that's mm-hmm. okay. Because I think sometimes this conversation gets framed in all or nothing terms, like saying sometimes I can be in this, a stretch zone and sometimes I'm not leaves room for me to be in a, like, I literally can't with men right now mood.
Yeah.
And then be able to can sometimes, right?
Like, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a really lovely way to think about it.
I mean, we talk about self-care. We talk about, you know, support systems and things like that as frontline educators. But I think it's a terrible thing that so many people doing the education about a kind of social injustice, like gendered violence, for example, are people who have experienced gendered violence, who are still wounded, possibly, from gendered violence, who are easily triggered by talking about gendered violence and talking to people who might be perpetrating gendered violence. I think for many years, I would not put myself in front of a room to do like a coming out story as a queer person. It was just like rewounding me all the time when a person in the room says, totally just out of curiosity, was it because you went to an all-girl school? I know, right? But as an educator who I feel like have scars, I can answer that question in a way that keeps that person in their stretch zone because I'm in my stretch zone, mm-hmm. or even in my comfort zone. But for many years, that kind of question would have sent me right into my panic, and I would have had to blow this person's head off.
Right. Right.
Right? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. Absolutely. So when you are in your stretch zone and they are also in their stretch zone, what's the approach?
My approach has been some kind of mishmash of helping someone understand their story. I think one of the perfect design of masculinity to fuck up this world, part of that design is that people who are practicing it first become dehumanized. Right. So men walk around assuming a certain power because they've been told and shown they have this power, but it doesn't come without a cost. And the cost is their dehumanization. That actually helps them dehumanize other people. And it looks like nothing. It feels like nothing. So when later on in life, somebody says, hey, stop dehumanizing your partner, your coworkers, your children, or whatever. You're holding everyone around you hostage. And you can call it a bad temper, or you can call it somebody who's sexually frustrated. Any one of these manifestations, when you confront this person, it feels like that's just what the world has done to me.
Right.
You know, right. So that's their experience.
And you hear, I mean, that's what you hear from, for example, the incels, right? Sort of like, and that's why I've started saying not just male entitlement, but aggrieved entitlement, because it is that sense of sort of like they genuinely feel like they are the victims.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It's kind of like people who think actually the jobs are all going to the immigrants.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yes. It's that same aggrieved entitlement that. Yeah, exactly. That's like a racist aggrieved entitlement. Yeah, or a xenophobic aggrieved entitlement. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And so why does that happen? It's because there is a problem. There is a stress in life, you know, a lack of a job, or I want to have sex and nobody wants to have sex with me. There's that thing that happens and I have no tools to make sense of it. I have no tools to get over it. I have no tools to heal from the pain. If I have no tools to even acknowledge the pain, right? So often, I think that's something that masculinity does. And I think that's something that also other kinds of privileges do. But specifically around masculinity, this idea that emotional pain is such a taboo. So then what we do is we grow these human beings into people who have almost no practice mm-hmm. of healing and managing pain. They might have practice of holding back their tears, of being, you know, have the shit beat out of them for, you know, being weak, but they don't actually have any skill or opportunity to practice this really important thing, which is when shit happens, how do I get onto the other side and still be aligned with my values of who I want to be?
Right.
And so I think this is where you've said, you know, most people believe and want to be good people and believe they are. And I do think that most people who do really hurtful things are doing their best. They just have a very reduced amount of goodness that they can do. And I think masculinity reduces that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
So, you know, back to your question, which is, how do you do it? Before I even talk about gendered violence and rape culture and maybe aggression that they show to the people in their family whenever they're embarrassed, you know, before we even get there, I have to tell the story of what might have happened to them so that they can start actually identifying with some of these experiences.
Whew. Is that really hard labor? Because for me, I grok why that is such an important step. And mm-hmm. I think it is a step that gets skipped a lot because it is so hard. As you know, you're right. The frontline people who are doing this work are often women, are often survivors of different kinds of male violence.
Mm-hmm.
And to say, like, in order to get you to stop hurting other people, we have to focus on you and feel your pain first. Like,
mm-hmm. I know.
How is that for you? How do you experience that work?
It's some days impossible and other days really okay. I situate myself this way. I think that I tried to practice masculinity myself. I was trying to parent myself into a boy secretly.
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of my experience as a young person. And so I have some experiences of the loneliness of masculinity as a young person who felt just nothing but fear. And all I could show was, I don't care. And so that sort of dichotomy of fear and apathy. And then other times when apathy wasn't good enough, then I had to show, actually, I need to hurt other people in order to get by. And then it kind of really set into me. I felt a kind of anger towards the world. That's part of it. I feel like I have some experience, although, you know, very different if the world expects it of me too. And then I have another side of the experience as a woman, as a queer person, as somebody, you know, as a person of color, who you just never know when something racist is happening. You know, did that mm-hmm. person, you know, dismiss me because of this or that? You just never know. Mm-hmm. And so having some insight into those things, it makes it easier for me. And it's interesting that, you know, I don't have to spend hours upon hours talking to a man about how he's the victim. But I just have to sometimes mention that masculinity produces a lot of loneliness, for example.
Mm.
And it takes away some of our tools for dealing with loneliness. And then it gives us two tools for dealing with loneliness. And those are sometimes hurting other people or withdrawing completely. So apathy and or aggression. And then I just really quickly see some kind of connection most of the time. You know, I'm not asking for them to cop to
right.
the violence they've done. And often we don't get there because it's such a charged thing to talk about now. You know, I actually think it's a terrible thing. And we talked a little bit about that in the workshop that you and I met at, that there's so much fear around taking accountability, right? We see what happens. People's careers are completely decimated. So I think I don't expect people in a room with me to be like, oh, yeah, you're right. I totally take it out on my kids or.
Right.
Right. I don't expect that.
Because they're thinking if I say that out loud, my kids may be taken away from me.
Yeah. All kinds of consequences.
Yeah.
Right now we have bad men and men we have yet to have found out are bad.
I mean, that is what it feels like.
Right? Yeah,
that is, I hate feeling that way. I don't philosophically believe that, but I feel that emotionally.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's really intense right now. And that is one of the things that hurt me the most, the unwillingness to figure out what I might have done that has hurt somebody. Not because I don't I essentially don't want to do that. But because I'm so afraid of like catastrophic things that could happen to me.
So if having severe consequences for sexual predations or abuses scares abusers out of being accountable, but having no accountability, right, like,
yeah,
just creates impunity. Like, let me ask you this question. I actually asked people when I interviewed them for my book, for Unscrewed, this question. Mm-hmm. I kind of want to ask it to you now.
Mm-hmm.
If I was a genie,
mm-hmm,
and I could grant you 3 wishes that would help to heal or build a new masculinity.
Yeah.
What would you use those 3 wishes on?
Wow. I think I would, for one, change the experiences that young people have growing up. The depth of disconnection, the depth of loneliness, the depth of nobody cares about me, so I don't care about them. I would want to change that. Well, I want that for everyone.
And would we change that by giving all parents a different kind of support, or by changing the way schools work, or all of the above and plus something?
Yeah, all of the above.
Yeah.
Plus something. What is that thing? Well, you know, it's funny because with such a hopeful question, this is when I feel my despair.
Mm.
Because even when I can wish for anything, I don't know what I could wish for that would change this network, this intricately formed system of dehumanization.
Mm.
So that's one of the things. Somehow disconnection feels like key.
Yeah.
That the moment that somebody feels a little bit more connected to be recognized as, you know, their full human self, that I think a lot of things become possible. And I do think it's a stage thing. Like, in this moment, we have to swing this way. We have to swing this far because there's like a huge barrier to change, right? We have to knock the barrier over. But it doesn't mean we should be doing Me Too for the rest of time.
What would be a humanizing reaction that would still involve accountability?
I think some smaller circles of people are trying it. So actually getting people to understand what harm they've caused. So maybe a conversation when the survivor is ready, but a lot of education, a lot of connecting with people who are important to the perpetrator, actually, and for there to be like a community so that you don't become excommunicated when you've been found to do something that's hurtful, that you in fact have people around you come closer to you and say, you must have really like missed the boat on something. So here we are going to help you. It's not people disappearing, but people appearing and staying by your side and say, you know, man, I'm going to hold you accountable. We're going to learn about this together and so on. And then I do think, aside from like learning theory and policy and rules and law, what's really important is to equip people with the ability to actually humanize the person they hurt. You know, so much of the hurt can happen because there is not a person there. I don't care how they feel.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And yeah. So I do think there we have tools. Psychotherapy has tools. Psychodrama has tools. Transformational justice have tools to make people feel something, not like to legislate and restrict them out of doing harm. So I don't know. It could, you know, you could talk to me in 3 years and I could be like, oh, that was such an idealistic.
I mean, I love it philosophically, but I do worry about 2 things in this conversation. One is the amount of labor that it would require of survivors. And I don't want to require, honestly, anything of survivors
yeah.
that they don't actively want to do. And
yeah.
not every survivor is going to have anything to do with their perpetrator ever.
Yeah.
And I want yeah. that to be totally fine. And I think
yeah.
sometimes talking about that kind of process puts pressure on survivors to like participate in healing a perpetrator. And I have just real protective mama bear concerns about that.
Yeah. And I totally agree. I think we cannot put somebody in that position.
Yeah.
But if they're willing to put themselves in that position,
they
because
want to.
Of what,
yeah.
Yeah. Because of what is in it for them.
Yeah.
Right. If it could be a part of their healing, and it is sometimes.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Right? And then that would be a perfect.
Yes. As an option. I love it. But then my other question is, I just think some of these guys are really good talkers, right? Like, and I think that there's some subset of them who can perform education and revelation and rehumanization and then go on to some other community, like, and just run their game again. And I literally don't know what to do about that. I'm not advocating, like, the answer is the prison industrial complex. I just...
Right.
I don't feel fully satisfied that we have an answer yet, I guess, is all I'm saying.
No, have to, I'm with you.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Yeah, please.
So you said that growing up, you sort of parented yourself into masculinity and that it led to a place where you were feeling a lot of anger and possibly even hurting other people.
Mm-hmm.
How did you move out? What was the intervention that mattered to you?
I became a feminist.
How did you become? But how? Like,
yeah,
what,
it was
what
by chance.
You? Yeah,
it was actually a total accident. I was just pretty stuck in a very small new development suburbs, and there was one library with a very small collection, and I was actually researching books in preparation for what I had at the time wanted, which was a sex change, a sex reassignment. And I was 15 or 16. And as you can imagine, in the small Meadowvale library, there were not a lot of books in the late 80s about sex reassignment surgery. They were actually mostly books from the 60s and 70s. So there was just like really horrific kinds of descriptions of what people would do to your body. So I read all those. And then they were next to books about queerness or lesbianism.
Right. Yeah.
And inverts. And so I read those as well, because, you know, sometimes they had like a chapter on special inverts who wanted to change their sex. And I read those. And then those happened to be next to feminist books. There was just like the Dewey Decimal System.
It was the Dewey Decimal System. That's amazing.
And I read the feminist books. And I, at that moment, I learned about racism. And I was like, oh, I think I've internalized a lot of racism. And so, you know, I think I was a product of like information that was given to me while I was not defensive. And I learned I was very misogynistic, and that while, yes, my gender unhappiness is a standalone experience, I had internalized a lot of misogyny. And that was hard, but because I was alone with a book, it was a little bit easier. I don't know if I would have been able to do that with a bunch of people telling me I was misogynist.
Like a bunch of people yelling at you on Twitter.
It's certainly not that, but even like well-meaning people in a room who would be like, you know, you've internalized this thing and or you've just, you know, absorbed it. So that's how I just started linking like a lot of anger about all different things and noticing when I lie about having been born in Canada versus being an immigrant, that is an example of this. And that's because of that. So it was by chance.
Do you remember what the books were?
I definitely read The Second Sex and some Betty Friedan and...
Wow, old school stuff.
Old school stuff. I read a lot of Gloria Steinem, Marilyn French, you know, all those good 70s.
Awesome.
I became basically a white feminist.
And then you needed to experience an intervention with that at some point, I would imagine.
Yeah. But, you know, it really helped me out a lot. I learned a lot.
That's amazing. So we're running out of time. I feel like I could talk to you like for a whole other episode. Maybe we'll do another one.
Yes.
But I wonder, before I let you go, if you could, for everybody listening, regardless of their gender, regardless of, or maybe you can specify if it differentiates, what would you have the average person listening do who's concerned about the current path of masculinity and wants to help bring something better into the world?
Well, one is to put ourselves in that stretch mindset and then go and have new conversations. So because of what is happening in my personal life this week, I'm remembering, you know, when my grandmother was dying years ago, and all of us were terrified. She was terminally ill. And all my aunties and uncles were like running around trying to cheer her up. But we talked about everything except how she was feeling, because we were afraid that she would say that she was afraid, or that she didn't want to die, or that she even knew she was dying. But the most important conversation that was had with her was when someone said, "Are you scared?" And everything about her changed. So I think that version of the conversation is, you know, to talk to the fathers who may have been tyrants in the home and now he's older, to actually maybe say, "Hey, those years, those were really hard for you." You know, not, I don't mean, you know, to erase the story and take away the story of the people who have been hurt the most, but also to recognize the pain often that's connected to the person who's striking out and hurting other people, if and when we can. And to say to the kid at school, you know, "You're sad today," as opposed to like, "Get up, you don't have anything to be sad about." So just to be a little bit less afraid of the softer, the sadder, the painful parts, because it's actually so much of the shit we're in is because we don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah.
And we don't have practice, and we hide it, and we lash out.
I think starting with kids is, for me, the easiest thing to conceive of, right? Because they're still forming, and honestly, it requires less of me than to say to someone who has been abusive, or, you know, like, you know, I think about my nephews, and I think a lot about what you said in that workshop about, you know, just like preparing men and boys to just be emotionally resilient, right? Like to have tools that if they get rejected, it doesn't feel like that they're dying, right? Like that like when we start by teaching everybody, all kids, but especially boys, that like that all of their feelings are okay and valid and important, and that being tenderhearted is a good thing. That's the piece that gives me hope, and that feels like a lift I can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel that way too, often with children, because the rest is really hard.
It's so important. Like, I'm so glad that you and other people are doing that work. I'm so glad. And then also, like, the idea of me approaching it is like, sounds like me approaching like a hot stove.
Yeah, I mean, that it makes so much sense. And I don't think we need to all do the same thing. You know, like, most of what you do, I could never do. I would be too scared.
Interesting.
You know, and I used to think, oh, do I want to talk about love and connection? Because I'm just a coward. And no, I guess I don't think I'm a coward. These things are hard for me too, and they take a lot of courage. But it's just how we're built. And I think, you know, we all serve our purpose somehow.
Yeah.
It's differently, right?
We need all of us. Because I think, like, I could never do what you do, and I'm so in awe of it. Yeah. So that's actually great. That's a great thing for us to both remember, and for everybody to remember, that we each are doing the piece that we can do the way that we can do it. Yeah.
And doing it well.
Yeah. Thank you so much. This is a great, I just feel a little better actually after talking to you.
Oh,
I know that wasn't the point, but it was really lovely.
I was going to say, I don't know if that's a good thing.
No, it is. I just feel seen and I feel calmer and I feel, you always make me feel a little, just a little softer and more tenderhearted, which is good.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So
thank you so much for talking to me.
Yeah. So Karen BK Chan, where can people follow your work and what do you have upcoming that people can connect to?
They can check me out at fluidexchange.org, O-R-G. And I basically am mostly there. I also am a very occasional tweeter and it's just at Karen BK Chan. Upcoming, I am doing a lot of trainings and presentations, which is the first love. I love speaking. And then I'm going to take a couple months off to try to put together a book proposal because one of these days I'd like to actually do some writing.
You have a lovely little book out.
I do. It's a little picture book and it rhymes. So if you go to my website, there's a way to get a hold of it. And then it's also in a number of little independent bookstores. But it's basically about facing the monsters inside of us that are really hard to look at. And then they feel bigger and bigger and bigger until you turn around and look at them.
And then they're kind of adorable.
And then they might be adorable. Or they could be really hard to look at.
Yeah.
Still.
They're less big when you turn and look at them. Anyway, it's a really lovely book and people should check it out. It's called Monster, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent. And folks can find me on Twitter at Jacqueline F, J-A-C-L-Y-N-F, and on Instagram at Jacqueline Effable, and on my website at JacquelineFriedman.com. Friedman is FRIEDMAN.com. I don't have a ton coming up, but I will have some things on the schedule soon. Summer tends to be my time to catch my breath. Yeah, and just in terms of public events, but you can find my writing and all that good stuff there too. And you can find Unscrewed, this wonderful podcast, wherever you like to listen to your podcasts, whether it's Apple Podcasts or Acast or Stitcher. While you're in your app or whatever you're listening to this, make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss an episode. And also, you know what I want you to do? Give us 5 stars and a little review to help other people find the show. It makes such a big difference and it makes my heart sing. Be tenderhearted and give us a little review. Unscrewed is produced and edited by yours truly, Jacqueline Friedman. The In and Out music is by The Pink Tiles, and our cover art is by Nicole DiDonna and was developed in collaboration with The Establishment, who also developed the sound cues. Until next week, I'm wishing you safe and happy sex lives.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.